Good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Noel Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends in the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press University Press, I should say, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birdings and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back to Bird Calls.
Hey, Bill, are you hearing me?
I'm hearing you, indeed.
Good, trying to get my microphone here working in my headset.
Well, I just put something up on Facebook that said that when I started this, I had two turntables and a microphone. Now I got four computers and a brain lock.
Yeah.
So there you go. We are here in our studio tonight, and we're going to ask you to call in with your questions about birds at 800-552-8502. Cliff will also identify photographs after the show for tonight. You can send those to me at wbeckett@lsus.edu. At the end of last month's program, Cliff, you gave us a conservation tip. Would you go ahead and refresh our memory on
that? Yeah, we talked about garbage and recycling, and that's maybe a tough one to swallow if you try to figure out how it connects to birds, but we did it last month. We talked about, we profiled the ring-billed gull and how they visit dumpsters sometimes and landfills looking for food scraps, but they also can get injured or trapped or ingest harmful substances like plastics when doing this. So garbage and recycling have something to do with being a good citizen, and that's, you know, trying to reduce all of the above. So you can get six or seven uses out of a cardboard box, and I don't mean reusing it, not just reusing it in your own household, but when you do recycle it, it can be crushed down, regurgitated, and used again six or seven times before it just disintegrates. So one thing I've always thought about would be really good for school groups to take field trips is to go look at a landfill, because when kids put stuff in a garbage can, that's the end game. They don't know what happens to it after that. Well, it has to go somewhere, and it really piles up. And I've been to landfills that have been used for decades that get capped over, and it's pretty impressive to think that you're, you know, walking on 50 years of junk underneath your feet. So recycle stuff, food scraps, that ties back into birds, because you can put your food scraps like peels and coffee grounds and apple cores in your mulch pile, and then use that mulch 6 or 12 months later when it's turned into really nutritious soil. You can use that in your wildscape. Wildscape is what we talk about all the time on this show, and that's landscaping for wildlife. So you can add that mulch that you've created from the beginning, and it feels good, and get your plants that extra nutrition so they can produce nectar that will attract hummingbirds and butterflies, or those berry-giving bushes that will bring you cedar wax wings and mockingbirds and robins. So it's a good system to get in. It might take you a little bit more time to do these things, but it feels good doing it, and it's the right thing to do.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have open lines right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And at the beginning of each show, we profile a species. What do you have for us this month?
The species we're profiling tonight is the Forster's Tern. First, let's look at the bird's name. The word Forster's has only one E near the end and is not spelled like the wooded forest. Instead, it's a patronym for Johann Forster, a German-born natural historian from the 1700s. The second word, tern, T-E-R-N, comes from the Scandinavian word for sea swallow, as in acrobatic birds that maneuver effortlessly in the air over water. So let's now listen to the common call of the forester's tern, which is a simple yet raspy descending cheer. So by simple, we mean not very musical. It's raspy. It's the common sound that you hear with this bird. There are about a dozen species of terns that occur on the Gulf Coast, and some of these species, like the forester's tern, move inland, including the Red River Radio listening area, on a seasonal basis, while others rarely leave the salt water. This species does not breed in our listening area, but does nest colonially along parts of the Gulf Coast. Again, forester's terns winter in our listening area, and anglers see them the most on our lakes, reservoirs, and wider rivers like the Red. Forester's terns have a pointy bill, pointy wings, and a deeply forked tail. In winter, they're snow white underneath, pale gray above, and are white-headed except for a noticeable black mask around the eyes. In spring, before the breeding season, these birds molt, and that black eye mask now connects to an all-black forehead, crown, and nape. Terns fly low over water in order to dive straight down for small fish that they catch with their bills, not with their feet. And to see a photo of a forester's tern in winter plumage snapped by James Childress of Lufkin, please visit the bird calls page at redriverradio.org.
And it is quite a nice photograph. You can see almost the individual feather lines in it.
The definition
is quite good.
James has mastered bird photography. He is our he's our resident bird photographer for this show.
Well, there you go. I think I'm jealous, you know, because I'm an amateur. But you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have lines open right now. You can get in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have Max on hold right now. Max from El Dorado, please stay with us. Davina from Nacogdoches, you're up first with Cliff. What's your question?
Actually, it's Nacogdoches, not Nacogdoches.
Oh, okay. Well, they put nag instead of nat, so.
Cool. I wondered if it's too early to put out hummingbird food. I see hummingbirds come in. I had a lot of them last year. I actually had an oriole or two coming through, it seems like, too. So I just wondered, you know, about what time of the year should I put that out for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So at our latitude, you know, Nacogdoches, Shreveport, Lufkin, Nacogdoches, that rough latitude, our ruby throats get back around March 17, March 18, somewhere in that ballpark. So that's already passed. So I would put my food out today. It would be good, or tomorrow. There's still going to be birds coming in, but the first arrivals have already passed through our yards. And so remember to use 4 parts water, 1 part sugar, and no other kind of sweetener except for white table sugar. I get that a lot. You know, what about sweet and low? You know, don't use any other sweetener except white table sugar. If you don't want to boil the water, you don't have to. Just make the water warm enough where you can stir it and dissolve it. If you brew iced tea, it's just as easy as brewing iced tea. Just don't serve it lightning hot to the birds. So, yeah.
No.
Yeah. All right. Well, good luck to you, Davina.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Davina. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can get in now. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. And you should probably never ask a hummingbird whether they want milk or lemon in their tea.
Oh.
So, you know.
I hadn't thought about that.
There you go, because they don't care.
Yeah.
We've got Max from El Dorado up next. Max, you're on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Hi, Cliff. I've got another bird feeding question.
Okay.
I feed the birds regularly and have a good population.
Uh-huh.
And recently I bought one of those bird bells at the grocery store. It's, you know, a cluster of bird feed probably stuck together with suet or something in the shape of a bell.
Anyway,
I hung it up closer to the kitchen window, thinking I would see them closer. and they wouldn't come. They waited and waited about a week, still no birds on it. So I moved it closer, hung it from a tree limb closer to the bird feeder, still no action. And so I put it in the bird feeder, and I was watching them. They totally spooked them. They won't even come. They won't even get up there, you know.
Weird. Yeah.
What's up with that?
I don't have an explanation. I mean, unless to them that funny shape of a bell looks scary to them. I don't know. I've never bought one of those. I've seen them. I've never tried it, but that's an interesting observation. So,
looks like the same stuff, sunflower seeds and, you know, millet and stuff. But, you know, if you change the bird feed, lots of times it'll spook them.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to warm up. But it's been 2 weeks and they hadn't touched this thing.
That's funny. Well, I don't think you should buy many more of those. I hope you didn't buy a whole box full.
And funniest of all, the squirrels won't even.
Oh, that's really bizarre. Maybe it's just
maybe it's poison or something.
Well, or maybe it's just too much sticky work to get to the seeds. I don't know. But, yeah, this is kind of like some food. You don't want to buy it by the case unless you taste test it. So it's a good thing you didn't buy a whole bunch of them because it sounds like you might be eating them.
I know. Right. Well, thanks so much.
Okay, Max. Thank you.
Bye-bye. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have open lines right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds in the avian world are welcome tonight. And we're going to go next to George from Central Louisiana. George, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
My question is regarding the two hummingbird migrations for the year, and I may be completely wrong, but I think there's a spring and a fall.
Yep.
And for some reason, there's a lot more numbers in the fall. Is it more species of hummingbirds that migrate in the fall compared to the spring?
No. Just think about what did they do in the summertime in between. They had babies. So you're coming back with a carload, so to speak, of babies. And so there's a lot more young of the year, and a lot of birds don't make it to their first birthday. Certainly, it's tougher even to make it to their second birthday. So it's easy to make it that first 6 months, and after that, it's really tough. But so the answer is you're seeing young of the year. You're seeing the progeny of that year. So that's why there's more in the fall. So it's not more species. It's just more individuals. They've had in this last year, we had a bumper crop because I noticed, and several people I've talked to, and that's September, October, bumper crop. And that means that they just did really well, I think.
Absolutely.
As breeders, yeah. So yeah, this is spring migration right now, and what goes up must come down. So those birds that are going up or north right now are going to come back south in September, October. That's the ruby throat. And if you're a listener out in West Texas where black chins are, that's going to be several weeks prior because black chin migration is earlier than ruby throated. The peak, at least. So just depends on where you are. But in our listening area, I would say if you want to see big numbers, the middle of September to the middle of October is definitely it. That third, fourth week of September, boy howdy, lots of hummingbirds. Yeah.
100%. And I have an additional question. I appreciate your answer in that one. The next one is with regards to the spring migration and then also the wisteria that's blooming, particularly right now. Do they have any hummingbirds have any attraction to this wisteria?
Yeah, that's a good question. Most of the purpley, lavendery looking wisteria we see, most of it is not native, and it has very little to no nectar value. The azaleas that dominate are from China. There are very few of the native azaleas out there. They're pretty finicky on soil type and shade and where they are on the landscape. But these ornamental ones we brought in, these Chinese ones, azaleas that you can put them in most lawns and put them in the shade. But they, too, have very little nectar value to wildlife. So they look good. A classic one is bougainvillea. And if people think, you know, wow, it's got to be bright and showy, critters learn real quick what is worth their time investigating and what's not. So the wisteria you mentioned, the Chinese azalea, which is the dominant azalea we see in yards, bougainvillea, and so many others, they don't have any value at all to wildlife. They look good, but that's it. And that's the kind of the issue we have in our wildlife field is, why not have something that's beautiful and
native
gives something back?
Yeah.
So, and those are the natives. So instead of going after the non-native wisteria, look into the native wisteria. And the same thing with the azalea. Just forget about bougainvillea. If you think they're beautiful, just put a portrait on the wall inside of, you know, and there's your beauty right there. But instead, look for the native plants like Turk's cap, salvias, penstemons, the native lantana. There's a lot of things that have color and give back to nature, so you got a double whammy instead of just something that looks good and has no value. To me, it's like having a restored 65 Mustang that's just beautiful, but there's no engine in it. You can't drive it. You can't enjoy it. It's like, well, why is it sitting in my driveway? I want to enjoy it. So that's
the bird love coming out of you, right?
That's
there.
It. That's right.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you, George.
I really appreciate it. Answer both my questions.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, George. And just out of curiosity, if you really wanted to plant nectar flowers and plants for hummingbirds, lantana, things like that, what are the best nectaring plants that would feed hummingbirds naturally and also add to the natural landscape?
Yeah. And the thing to think about is when they pop out is important, too. So you the answer is not just one species, because that might be a limited window of time during the spring, summer, fall months. So you want to get a variety of things. So again, salvias, there are various species of salvias. There's Turk's cap. There's the native lantana. Investigate that. Also, in my city of Nacogdoches, we have the native plant sale, mm-hmm. and that's going to be happening the first Saturday of April. And let me get the date on that. I don't have my calendar.
Well, that would be the 6th, the first Saturday in April.
I didn't know I was going to mention that, but that is a fantastic place. Yeah, April 6th. In Nacogdoches, starts at 9 o'clock. That is a fantastic place to get native nectar-giving plants. They're already vetted. They're already native. They're ready to go. And if you live within 2 or 3 hours of Nacogdoches, it's worth it. You know, if you live in Galveston, that's a different climate, the different soils. But if you're in the Piney Woods anywhere and of any direction, that is the getting place for nectar-giving plants. And other plants that are good for your backyard and that give back to wildlife.
And that way you can have a natural landscape that feeds the natural wildlife and feeds the natural wonder and is still pretty.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have Robert and Leon on hold right now. I'm going to throw out a quick question to Cliff, and this is about the robins flocking in Nacogdoches. A man wrote in Link Hall about thousands of them flocking into Nacogdoches in February, and he was wondering, were they roosting there all winter, or are they just now getting together? What is bringing them all together there?
And that was a February question, and that's kind of changing now that we're deep into March and getting into spring. But in the winter months, namely January, February, you can find robins wandering widely throughout our listening area. Throughout the South, they're looking for berry-giving bushes and trees. They're also scouring the ground for earthworms and other invertebrates. But if you watch them carefully, they're looking for berries. And once they strip a berry bush or berry tree, that's not going to produce more berries for another, you know, growing season. So they have to move on. So they wander widely. If you see big groups and it's getting to be dusk, there is probably a communal roost nearby. And I've noticed one right here on the LSUS campus. Hmm. We're right on the edge of the campus here. And when I come in the winter months for bird calls, right at dusk, You can see huge numbers of robins pouring into those live oaks and roosting with them. There are lots of starlings, a few cowbirds, a few grackles, but robins are the nucleus of that winter flock.
And you say they eat the berries and seeds. Do they actually, are they cedar birds, meaning that they, through their excrement, they leave the seeds out and actually create a proliferation of new berry plants and things?
Yeah, they're the Johnny Appleseed of a lot of things. And also they're great if you own a car wash. And and right now the car washes are loving not only the loblolly pine pollen all over our cars, leaving that yellowy green film, but also if you're parked underneath a berry bush, berry tree where robins or cedar waxwings have come to feed, and that fruit goes through very quickly through their digestive system, and so what goes in must come out, and all of a sudden you can get just splattered, your windshield, your hood. And you know, quick trip to the car wash is usually what happens next.
Good reason for a garage or a carport and a big yard where you want berry bushes. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Leon, please stay online. We've got to go to Robert first. And Robert, you're up next from Central Louisiana. What's your question for Cliff?
Thanks for taking my question, Cliff.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about owls in my neighborhood, which is near a bayou. We have Barda owls.
Okay.
And it seems like it's almost a community. My dog demands to be walked twice a day, early in the morning and late in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And the question, or what I've seen is that they all seem to have unique calls and they seem to, at those times of the day, they seem to be communicating with each other.
They are, and starting in the late winter, they start courting. And so they're very vocal, and you hear a lot of that caterwauling where they're all wah, 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 and get really crazy loud and cackling. And then you'll hear the neighboring pair hooting back, and there's a little bit of territorial dispute, and it's mostly it's mostly a shouting match. It's mostly you know, the neighbors are saying no, we're still over here, we still own this property, you guys keep over on your property. But yeah, they're definitely getting after it right now with the courting and all the hooting and hollering. And that's a good one. Does it get your dogs all worked up?
Well, my dog is 18, and your hearing's not too good. What I started doing is mimicking a call, and they started flying around to see who it was, you know, and what they were doing.
Right, and they think you're an intruding owl, and they're coming to make sure that, you know, there's not an intruder on their territory. So, barred owls, they're not going to swoop at you.
No.
They're just coming in, they're curious, and they're really cool, and I love hearing them, and it's too bad your dog doesn't hear them anymore, but I bet in her heyday she heard plenty of them.
Yeah, she did. But, you know, they're fascinating animals in the way they have territory and the way they hunt and everything. It's really fascinating.
And
when they fly, they look like flying toasters, you know. So big.
Yeah, and they are pretty kind of flat, you know, the face looks flat, so it does look kind of blocked like a toaster. I hadn't thought of that. So, yeah, good observation. Well, thanks for the call, Robert.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Robert. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have Gail on hold right now. Gail, please stay on the line because Leon is up next from Bossier City. Leon, what's your question for Cliff tonight?
The sound in the morning of a little guy, of a bird, that I interpret him saying, Judy.
Well,
I think that's the Cary Grant bird, isn't it?
I think so.
Well, let's swing this one over to Bill and see if he can fire up the Carolina Wren.
All right. Well, you got to give me a second, so keep talking.
So Carolina Wren is my guess, Leon. You've nailed it on the head with the call. Let's see if this sounds like it.
I got two of them, so I can go to the other one.
Let's do the other one. There it is. Judely, 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 do.
That is a Cary Grant bird.
Yeah. And there's
Carolina Wren.
Yeah, and there's some dialect difference, and even if you listen to the same individual for hours, it'll tweak it a little bit. So that one that Bill played might not be exactly like yours, but the way you've described it, that's a Carolina Wren. And a lot of people call them house wrens because they've heard of a house wren. They're in their house. The bird's on the adjacent side of the house, the outside of the house. So it must be a house wren. That's not how to identify birds. This bird is different.
Is that that little bitty guy that builds his nest like in 1 or 2 days?
Yes, and they build a real sloppy nest in a shoe cubby or a potted plant. Or a reef that you leave around the front door, or in a little crack or a coffee cup or an old boot, anything. That's the Carolina Wren. It's a pretty big, sloppy nest, but you're right. They build them pretty fast.
Yeah, and he's a little bitty guy to make a whole lot of noise.
Yeah, he's a little bitty guy with a big voice. So, pretty cool. Well, thanks for the call, Leon.
Thank you for your information.
Yeah,
all right, and thank you, Leon. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have a full bank of calls right now, so we hope everybody will stay online. Gail is next, but Marsha, Ruth Ann, and Chris, please stay on the line. We'll get to you in just a few minutes. Gail on I-20, you're on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Well, first of all, our master gardener's plant sale is this Saturday. The 30th of March.
And that's in Marshall, correct?
Right. In Marshall, we have tons of new plants that are coming to us at Texas A&M that are experimental as well as what we all donate, number one. Number two, I swear I have a bird in my backyard that says, boogie, woogie, woogie, boogie, woogie, woogie. And I know Marshall is the home of boogie, woogie, but I swear this bird is saying boogie, woogie, boogie, woogie.
Huh.
What is
boogie woogie? That's a different interpretation. I guess, Gail, I'm going to have to throw that one back at you to record it, and you can do that with your cell phone. Use the video function, and don't worry about picking up any visual. Just capture something with the microphone and see if we can hear that.
Just set it out in the backyard and walk away and let it go for about 5 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, the tufted titmouse, let's play that one, Bill. That tufted titmouse, I interpret it as Peter, 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 or here, here, here. Let's just see if Gail thinks that maybe it's a tufted titmouse. Not quite. Okay.
I do have tufted titmouse.
Yeah.
Have lots of mockingbirds, and I have five pairs of cardinals back here.
Okay. Well, so
they don't say boogie.
No, I don't ever use that one, but it's a good one if you like the type of music. That's a good way to interpret it. But no, I think Gail, you're gonna have to call us back with that recording, and maybe we can help you then. Okay,
right.
Thanks for calling.
I wonder if it's the Omar Sharif bird, the father of Boogie Woogie.
Yeah,
it could
be
too. So you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and Cliff Shackelford is here with us, as well as the guy who makes the bad jokes. And we are going next to Marsha from Shreveport. Marsha, you are on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Yeah, okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah, is this Marsha?
Yes, it is.
Okay, right. You're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Just wanted to say thanks to Ms. Beal about the plug to the Marshall Native Plant Sale this weekend. And also the Nacogdoches Native Plant Sale. Is Freeport in that region that I could get plants that would possibly do
well? Yeah, as I mentioned, if you're 2 or 3 hours from Nacogdoches and I make the drive, it's 98 miles. Less than 2 hours. Absolutely, yes. You should definitely take part and drive that far. It's worth it. And it sounds like the Marshall one, of course, is closer, and it's you know a couple weeks before, or at least a week before. So that means you don't have to make a decision on the same day. You can do both. You can spend lots of money on native plants.
And put lots of time in my yard.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yep. All right, Marshall. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
And I'm wondering if anybody from the Shreveport area knows if there's a native plant sale coming up as well. You might want to give us a call at 800-552-8502. We have Chris on hold. Chris, please stay with us because, well, we lost Chris, but we're going to go to Ruth next. Chris, if you would like to call back in, you'll get right in after Ruth. And Ruth, you're on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Well, I think it's a question of more of a migratory bird, and I'm not sure it's pertinent for Chris, but Canada geese.
Okay.
We've got... over the last couple of years where I live, which is a rural area north of Marshall, lots and lots of Canada geese. And then now we see them in groups all, you know, winter, and now they're splitting up, and we've got a nesting pair on a pond at our house. And we found 5 eggs on the nest yesterday. And all day today, we've seen both the mom and the dad, the female and the male. They haven't been anywhere near that nest all day long, and we're concerned.
Well, first of all, if you've got Canada geese breeding in our listening area, they're not native. They've got some domestic stock in them. They're not wild stock, and that would kind of make sense with not really going through the full motion of nesting. So I wouldn't be concerned because they're not supposed to be breeding here. There are areas in the country where Canada geese have moved in and they have overpopulated, and those communities have to deal with major issues of birds attacking kids at parks, that these geese leave big piles of poo and then kids walking in the poo and touching it. So I wouldn't want to even venture. I wouldn't even want you to deal with trying to raise those eggs. Just let nature take its course. But those are those have domestic blood in them. They're not supposed to be breeding here, and because they're nesting right now and because they're approachable, that should tell you a lot. When you go up farther north or even parts of the listening area where real wild geese are, you cannot get out of the car before they fly off, and that way you know they're wild and wary. So that should be a red flag to any observer. Hey, look at this goose I'm feeding bread. It's coming right up to me.
Right.
That's not a wild bird. Someone has raised it. It's had a life in a cage. It's used to humans. It's not wild and wary.
We haven't approached them at all. When they were gone from the pond, we saw the nest.
Yeah.
And we've stayed away. Last year they made a nest as well, and we watched and watched, and once they were gone after what we thought was a long period of time, we found the babies smushed, smothered in the nest.
Okay.
I guess maybe these guys aren't real adept at what they're doing.
They've just not figured things out. They're just DUMB. I'm sorry to put it that way, but they grew up in a cage. And you said you're in Northeast Texas somewhere?
Yeah, Marshall.
Okay.
Area.
Yeah. So yeah, I would focus on the natives, and Canada goose is not that individual pair is not going to be a wild and wary bird.
So just let nature take its course.
Yep.
Suppose.
Yeah. Okay. Don't look for a rehabber. They're not going to want to mess with it. They're focused on wild stock birds. I mean, you're getting into cats and dogs and horses and chickens and goats and farm animals. That's what we're getting closer to than wild and wary.
Okay. Well, that's disturbing, really.
Well,
a little bit.
Yeah.
But we thought we were just seeing the wild geese.
Nope. If you go up to some of the parts of Arkansas north of us and Oklahoma where there's tens of thousands of Canada geese wintering, you'll know the difference. You cannot get close to them at all. So, okay. Yep.
Okay, well, thank you for
all
the
right,
information.
Thanks, Ruth.
Thank you. It's the same with the great egret. They're not going to let you get real close to them. I've tried, and they just don't like me coming up close to
them.
That's
right, that's right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding the avian world and birds is welcome. And Chris is back online from, I believe it's Spurger, Texas. Chris, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
All right. Thanks, man.
Is that Spurger? Spurger.
Spurger. Okay.
Yeah. Tyler County. I know where that is.
I've got to get my names correct.
Yeah. You're right near my town of Fred, Texas.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I know Fred.
Yeah. And Warren, there's a whole bunch of buddies down there. Fred and Warren, Texas. So.
Yep, the whole gang are all clustered together.
That's
there.
Right.
My question is, I'm not originally from here. I just moved here less than a year ago, and I brought with me some cuttings of forsythias. That make the little yellow flowers, and I was wondering, is that something that will attract hummingbirds?
I have to stick to my guns here and say go with the natives, go with stuff that belongs here. Where did you bring these from?
They originally came from Missouri.
Yeah, I'd say leave Missouri in Missouri. I got nothing wrong. I got no problem with Missouri. Just leave it there. And now that you're in Texas, I see you got here as quick as you could, Chris. But and you picked Spurger. Man, you picked the country.
Well, yeah, kind of ended up.
Yeah,
here,
you got the Neches.
I ran out of gas.
You got the Neches River there. You got the part of the Big Thicket National Preserve near you. I mean, that's a great area.
Yeah, I'm right in the Big Thicket.
That's awesome. Okay. Yeah. That's awesome.
If you're a wildlife lover, that's a great place.
Yep.
Oh, it's beautiful out here.
Yeah, and are you seeing swallowtail kites yet? Have you seen that bird yet? It's a black and white raptor with a scissor tail.
I have seen those.
Yeah, that's a cool one, and you're right in the heart of them.
Whenever I first saw them, I was like, what in the world is this?
Yeah.
I didn't know what it was.
Yeah, they don't have those in Missouri. And so, yeah.
No, they don't.
No, that's for sure. So. Cool.
I should stick to like the azaleas and stuff like that.
Well,
for hummingbirds.
Stick to the natives. So when we say azaleas, don't get the Chinese ones that you can get at the big box store.
Uh-huh.
You know, they might be hardy, they might look good, but you're going to stand there waiting for something to use it, and there's not going to be a fly, bumblebee, hummingbird, just very little activity, if any, at all. So. I'd look into Turk's cap and salvias. Those are easy. Those will actually spread if you let them, and that's good because then the next year your patch got bigger, and the next year it got bigger, and so then you got a whole bunch of nectar giving plants that are native. They're acclimated to Spurger, Texas. They can handle these wet spells that we have. If it's something that likes cold of Missouri, we don't have that in Spurger. So get stuff that's acclimated to your area, and you'll do a lot better.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks for your advice.
Thanks, Chris.
You bet.
Yes, sir. Goodbye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have Kelly on hold. Please stay with us, Kelly, because Francis is up next before you. Francis from Shreveport, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff, really like your show. Thanks so much for being on the radio. I'd like to ask a question, and then I'll hang up and listen to your response. We have a friend who's a big fan of bird watching and such. He's getting a little older, though.
Uh-huh.
And he's reported recently, this past summer, that an eastern phoebe showed up at his property and regularly would show and land in his hand or on his shoulder. And we wonder whether... maybe he's just, you know, imagining that, if you think. And
right.
And he's expecting and hoping that the eastern phoebe will return this summer and visit him again. I've never seen an eastern phoebe in Shreveport or in Caddo Parish. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can comment on your experience with that bird and whether it comes through the area and if it does, is it likely to show up either in his imagination or in his backyard again for him to enjoy it?
Well,
thanks a lot for listening.
Okay, thank you, Francis. And the Eastern Phoebe, let's start off by explaining how that is a flycatcher. And so it does live in backyards. It will be in the Shreveport area, especially in the winter months. And a lot of our birds leave us, a lot of our Phoebes leave, but some do stay and breed. And actually, some friends of ours, the Llewellyns in Nacogdoches, they showed me a nest 3 days ago that had 5 eggs in it of an Eastern Phoebe on their front porch. So sitting on his shoulder, I have a hard time believing that. We've had them nesting in our yard. And I would think that maybe he's got a bird that's dive bombing him. If he's a few inches from the nest, it might flutter at him, try to look big and mean and tough. But, you know, like what's the guy who had the Mr. Bluebird on his shoulder? Gosh.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what movie that was from the 1950s. But no, that I don't think that he's got one sitting on his hand or on his shoulder. I think it's, if anything, it's getting close to him because he's getting too close to the nest. Or like you suggested, he's imagining it. And there's nothing wrong with that. If he loves birds, that's a good one to have in your thoughts and have as your best friend sitting on your shoulder. So I like Eastern Phoebes, and I know some friends that have named their daughters after that bird, and that's a great name to have, Phoebe, the bird.
Sounds like a profile species of the future.
Yeah, well, I think I've got my list here. I bet you we've done Eastern Phoebe. Let me look down my list. Well, gosh, has it eluded us?
It has eluded us. I do not
look
have
at
it.
That. I've got Eastern everything. Eastern bluebird.
Meadowlark.
Eastern meadowlark. Well, look at that. We're going to have to profile the Eastern Phoebe sometime soon. And I have some future stuff here, and I don't see it. So, poo.
There you go.
We got a homework assignment, don't we, Bill?
There we go. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we do have lines open now at 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. Our last caller that we have on hold right now is Kelly from Alexandria. Kelly, your question, please.
Good evening. Thanks for taking the call. We love watching birds in our backyard and have several feeders out with typical sunflower seeds and those sorts of things. But this year we experimented with a feeder that's a long cylinder that has those very, 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 very fine seeds.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they, and I don't know what the name of them are.
The thistle, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, and they're a lot more expensive of a seed.
Right.
Yep.
And we were pleasantly surprised to look out one day and probably had a dozen, and I don't know if they're finches or what they were. They're sparrow-shaped,
uh-huh.
Smaller than a sparrow, yellow with black.
Yep, that's the American goldfinch. They're also pine siskins that are real streaked with a little bit of yellow flashes in the wings and tail. So you could have had a mixture of siskins and goldfinches.
They showed up like gangbusters for probably 3 weeks, maybe a month, and
cool.
Then, bam, they're gone.
Yeah. Those birds, probably in late February, certainly by 1st of March, when the trees start budding, especially the elms, all those birds, they don't really leave. They just go straight up, and they're eating the real nutritious buds off of the trees, and you got to use your ears to re-find them. They're up there chirping and calling and fluttering around and just loving it because, you know, the seeds we put out is just supplemental. We have to remember it's not sustenance. So, and it's something that came out of a sweaty sack versus right up there in the elm tree is this just super juicy, nutritious, and tasty tree bud that these birds are nibbling on and getting a little bit of moisture, some vitamins, and some vegetable matter off of those tree buds. So So a lot of those shot right up in the trees once those were available, and they left our fast food of our bird feeders and went to Mother Nature's gourmet buffet.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you. And if we have time for one other.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've also seen feeders where they're it looks like seed that's sort of encapsulated in a block of wax or something. And you put the whole contraption in a little small metal cage.
Yeah.
What birds does that typically attract?
Yeah, that was one of our first callers. That was our second caller, Max from El Dorado. I'm cheating here looking at my notes. He called about a bell-shaped bird feeder where it's all stuck to probably soot. And so you'll see that a lot for sale, and that's probably what you had. It doesn't have to be shaped in a bell, but those are soot cakes. And so S-U-E-T, and that's just animal fat, and it's hardened. And it works really well where places stay cold, but if you're in, say, Brownsville, Texas, where there's not much winter and there's not much cold, that soot can liquefy, and then you've got a nasty, sticky mess that the ants sure love. So soot cakes work really well in Minnesota in the winter and Montana in the winter, but some parts of the South that we have a very short window where they work, otherwise they just liquefy. So, did you try them out?
We've seen no traffic on the.
Okay,
thing, so we can get rid of it.
And yeah,
I think the person y'all were thinking about earlier was Uncle Remus.
Okay, yeah, that's it, Uncle Remus. And what was the movie?
Song of the South, I think.
Yeah, and I don't. I thought maybe in the 50s, but that's just movie trivia, not bird trivia. So,
Mr. Bluebird on my shirt.
Yes, that's the one. Thank you, Kelly, for that. Now I can sleep tonight.
Have a good evening.
Thank you,
Kelly. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open now at 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. When he said Mr. Bluebird, the song Mr. Sandman came to mind. So now I'm stuck with that in my head all night. So I have no idea. So we have Leon back online from Bossier. Leon, what's your question?
I'm sorry, I'm double dipping tonight.
Oh, that's all right. Just can't ask the same question twice.
Okay. I have a pair of red-tailed hawks that have nested the last few years, and I think that they train their little ones on the ground for moles, M-O-L-E-S, moles and gophers that are out there in what I call the North 40.
Okay.
They're on the ground with them, and they're pecking and digging and stuff. Am I imagining that? Did the hawk come down on the ground and try to find a critter that's underground?
They can do that. You'll be able to go over there and see, though, if there's actually a pocket gopher mound or the ridge that a mole left, maybe. But I've seen our backyard red-shouldered hawk, a different species than your red-tailed, that'll go to the ground and grab something and go, and I look, there's nothing there with binoculars. I think it's just too small to see, and I think it's crickets or grasshoppers or something like that. And so I think they're getting, if you can get 50 of them, that's a meal. That's what a Cheeto bag is. If you just had one Cheeto, that's not a meal, but a bag of them, I'm sure, is. So I think that they could be eating stuff that you're not seeing if you don't see signs of those, what we call fossorial mammals. Those are the mammals that are burrowing underground, pocket gophers, moles. Yeah. Shrews are under the leaf litter usually. You'll have to do a little investigating, and a high-powered binoculars can help, but I've done the same thing you have, Leon, and I'm perplexed, and I just think it's grasshoppers and stuff that are hopping on the grass, hidden in the grass that I can't see, but they're clearly grabbing something and eating it, but it's the size of a Cheeto.
Well, the thing is, they're on the ground for 5-10 minutes.
Okay.
Digging and all. It's not that they just
swoop in and grab something and leave, they're down there looking and walking around and digging a little bit and pecking.
And the babies will do that. The young of the year, they do all kinds of exploratory investigating. At first, they do what we call branching. You'll see raptors that get out of the nest and walk up and down branches, hop to the next limb, walk up and down.
Yes.
They're learning how to live. Well, then they take their first hop off and they say, ooh, I'm not really ready to fly. They'll go to the ground. and they're just kind of figuring out how to be a bird. So you might be you might be seeing that too, Leon. You might be seeing a bird that's not mastered flight yet. It's a young of the year who's just trying to figure out how to be a bird. And when we see that in our yard, we need to pull in the pets because we all know what a dog and a cat's going to do. And with a songbird, that's never good for the bird. But with a hawk with big talons, it might not be good for the pet. Because you cannot blame a hawk for trying to protect itself or mom and dad trying to protect it. And you don't want your 10-pound puppy to get in the middle of all of that. So if you've got a little toy dog, you want to bring that in just to make sure it doesn't get mixed up with a protective hawk.
Also, if you have a big dog, you don't
want
to damage
the
raptor. You know?
Yeah,
right.
So any
now
pet.
That you mentioned it, the mature hawks I have not seen doing what I described previously.
Yeah.
It is only with when the little ones come out of the nest, and it's obvious that mom and dad are flying with them, and they're right close and everything. And there it's the little ones, I'm calling the yearlings,
right,
that are on the deck at the mole.
Yeah, so you're just seeing young learning how to be a hawk.
All right.
Yeah. All right, Leon. Thanks for the call.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have another caller online, Lee, not sure, from Natchitoches. You're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hi, you guys. You got it right the first time.
Yeah, I kind of figured it. Yeah.
So I know this is Bird Calls, but I have a question about bats that relates to birds.
Okay.
So we have a decent size front yard, and we get bats, you know, in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been talking about putting up a bat box, and I'm just wondering if that will affect the birds that I get during the day, because I get pretty red birds, pretty blue birds, and I'd like to keep those, but I don't want the bats to, like, scare them off.
Well, they're really oblivious of one another, and partly because all the bats we have in our area are insectivorous. Mm-hmm. They're not carnivorous. They're not going to prey on the birds. They're not going to mess with the birds. And plus, by the time the bats start emerging, all your songbirds are going to bed. So there's a changing of the guard. There might be a few minute overlap, but it's not enough to mess with them. And then also, these guys have coexisted for millennia, long before you and I have been here or any other settlement, you know, that these things have coexisted and they do just fine. So I don't see a problem. What I would tell you, though, is our bat boxes have very low success rate, very, very low. So don't invest a lot of time and money in a bat box. The climate has to be just right. Bats are real particular. If you have it on the wrong side of the tree, it might make it too hot, too cold, too moist, too dry. They are finicky. So what most of our bats are looking for are hollow trees. So we've talked about leaving dead and dying trees if they're not going to fall on the house or the playscape or the cars. Because that might be home for wildlife, including bats. So you might consider, you know, leaving the dead wood up. If you want to go try for a bat box, just remember it's probably got a 0.0-something% chance of working. I don't have any data to support that, but I'm just telling you in my experience, it's less than 1%. And I'm sure the bat people don't want to hear that, but go for it. Put up a box, but don't spend a lot of money because you're not going to get a lot of return.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, you bet.
All right, thank you, Leah. And you have been listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And I was just thinking that when I was at the University of Florida, they put up a huge bat cage. And it took years for them to get all the bats out of the stadium, the football stadium, over there. But it did eventually work out, and now people gather around this huge, huge, huge house, you know, and wait for the bats to leave at night because it's quite a magnificent sight to see, but it took them almost a decade to get all of that in place.
And I didn't mention old buildings, old cisterns and wells. Those are used heavily by bats. Those are man-made structures. Right. The city of Huntsville, Texas, is dealing with an old part of the prison in Huntsville that's got probably an estimated 700,000 bats, I think, three-quarters of a million. Maybe I'm off by that by a good bit, but there's a giant colony in Huntsville. They're trying to get out of a building and move into boxes, and it's just not easy. They want to demolish the building.
Sounds like a guano farm to me, if you want to make some money. All right, Cliff, we close every show with a conservation tip, and what do you have for us this month?
Tonight, we're going to talk about properly discarding our used fishing line. According to a national sport fishing report published a few years ago, there were nearly 60 million anglers in the U.S. who generated over $46 billion in retail sales that year, billion. One of the most commonly purchased pieces of fishing equipment is monofilament fishing line. Each active angler can go through miles of that stuff in their lifetime. Fishing line is made of plastic, such as nylon, which reportedly takes centuries to decompose. Anyone who visits the beach will see gobs and gobs of used balls of fishing line washed up on the beach. The species we profiled tonight, the Forster's tern, can get entangled in fishing line that was tossed out as litter. This is a totally preventable death sentence for that bird, as well as other water birds, turtles, and other wildlife. Many popular public fishing spots have fishing line receptacles, those white PVC tubes where unwanted fishing line can be discarded. If you're beach combing or walking out on a dock over a lake and you see a bundle of used fishing line blowing around, be sure to grab it, stick it in your pocket, and get it into a trash can later. Birds, turtles, and other wildlife have enough obstacles to deal with. Don't let used fishing line littering our shorelines and waters be an additional hazard. So properly discard any used fishing line. Do it for the birds.
All right. And you have been listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And our program is made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Cliff Shackelford is the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program tonight. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help from our phone bank people, Wally Derleth, Tim Schnell, and Sheila Lawrence. And we just remind you that next month on April 9th, we have our annual Birds and Bugs show, and that is going to welcome Dr. Beverly Burden here with Cliff Shackelford. They're going to talk about the birds that feed the bugs and the bugs that feed the birds and
the bees
and the annoyance thereof. So it'll be a fun show. Join us on Tuesday, April 9th, for that episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You. The sound files used in tonight's profile species was from xenocanto.org and was recorded by Paul Marvin. This month's bird photo on the Bird Calls page was snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be posted online in about an hour or two. And if you have a photo of a bird or a sound clip that you would like Cliff to identify, you can send that to wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. And we will get back to Cliff, and he will identify that bird or that sound for you. You have been listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we are a community-supported public broadcasting service of LSUS. This is KDAQ Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Camden Magnolia, KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, and KTYK Overton Tyler Kilgore. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is coming up next right here on Red River Radio.